I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. According to the People's Almanac, David Brenner holds the record for most guest appearances on TV talk shows. And on top of that, he worked almost nonstop during the first decade of his career, 7 nights a week, until he had taken care of his family and his old street corner pals from South Philly, where he grew up. He went on stage the night his mother died, and he went on stage the night of September 11th. Well, out of that last performance came a national tour to keep the country's spirits up, and his latest book, I Think There's a Terrorist in My Soup, How to Survive Personal and World Problems with Laughter Seriously, from Andrews McMeel, deals with that. I'm very pleased it has brought David Brenner back to the show. Hi.
Oh, that's good seeing you again. Hi.
There, this is something the entertainment world has struggled with for a long time, whether anything funny could be said about September 11th or come out of September 11th. You seem to have been sure from the start how you would respond.
I was actually shocked that comedians stopped working and that comedy stopped. I had exactly the opposite. It started because I was, you know, in a sense, forced to work on September 11th. I didn't want to work that night. But I worked for a corporation in Las Vegas that owns a lot of hotels. And you either work that night or you don't work anymore. You know, in corporate America, we know the kindness. We know how their heartbeat
is. If you don't show
is.
Up on Sunday, you're not going to get, you don't come in on
don't,
Monday.
Don't come on Monday. It's the same thing, no matter how high up you are in your field. But what I learned that night, interestingly enough, and I was trying to find out all day on the internet who was alive and who was dead of people I knew. What I learned that night, without mentioning anything about what happened on that particular day, because I work on current events, I had to avoid that, and I still do. There's nothing funny in what happened. But what I learned is that if you can laugh, you can live. And I decided that Americans had to laugh. And I started this tour, which I called Laughter to the People. And I was surprised that every comedian wasn't running around the country doing this. And the audiences were the most appreciative audiences I've ever had.
Well, now we're seeing it more. People talking about the things you have written about here. You're finding things funny in the way we reacted to what happened on 9/11. The color-coded alert system, for example.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And things of that sort.
Well, that's how I got the title of the book, actually. You know, I was talking one night about the color code. And first of all, Tom Rich has green and blue backwards. You know, he has green is the hotter color. It's blue is the hotter color. So I can imagine every kid in school going, wait a minute, we just learned about the rainbow. And I don't understand. You know, so right away, he made a mistake there. And then using colors is idiotic. You know, fuchsia, whatever colors. And it pops up the orange and yellow. And then when it pops up and it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. And we're warned to be on the lookout, to keep our eyes open, to be vigilant. Meanwhile, we're not told what we're looking for. And I travel the country, and Americans are in a state of panic. I mean, they're walking in a mall, they see a midget, they panic. Oh, look at him! He's going to blow up. It's a bomb. You know what I mean? So I said one night on stage, I said, we're getting to the point. I think that I wouldn't be surprised if one day you're sitting in a restaurant and you hear some guy go, waiter, I think there's a terrorist in my soup. And then I thought, oh, there's the title of this book.
And is he doing the backstroke?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, right. Is he doing the backstroke? Of course.
Well, we have perhaps overreacted, some people would say. The USA Patriot Act has caused a lot of alarm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's frightening. No, it's frightening because I'm not a student of our Constitution to know whether it's right and wrong in a sense it violates our Constitution. But it's frightening to know when you give the power to any government, it's frightening. But we have to do something to catch the people. But we don't catch anyone. It's amazing to me that a country as small as Israel, they know that on Tuesday at 12 minutes after 12, that one of the top terrorist leaders is going to get into a white Chevy with this license plate. He's going to drive 2 blocks, make a right on Moshula Avenue, and then stop in Abdul's coffee shop for a small gathering of friends. They know this. We can't find anyone. It's just amazing. We're waiting for them to come to us. It just amazes me that our intelligence is so lacking, and they hire people who we find out are now our spies in Guantanamo. I mean, what is wrong with us? Where's the great generation of World War II? Where are they?
Osama bin Laden is 6'5" or something like that.
6'5". Yeah, and here's what the FBI said. They had information, reliable information, that he dyed his hair red and got on a bike and went into Pakistan. Now, let's use a little
common
sense.
He's still 6'5".
He's 6'5". You have an Arab, 6'5", with red hair on a bicycle. You never notice him, right? We would never notice him. I mean, it's a joke. It's a bad joke.
So why do you think we can't... it's obvious why we can't find the weapons of mass destruction. Yeah, but why can't we find Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein?
Well, I'll tell you why we can't find him is because we diverted our attention from, you know, we went to the Taliban, we pushed them out of the neighborhood, more or less, and said, stay there. And then we backed off and we put in this provincial government and we're giving them very little money. You know, instead of taking all the money and doing, look, you take that $87 billion right now. This is all my opinion. What do I know? I'm only a comedian. But if you took that $87 billion, and you divide it in half, and you used half of it to get bin Laden and get rid of the al-Qaeda there, and use the other half to make Afghanistan the jewel of the Middle East. So everyone would go, wow, did you see what's happening in Afghanistan? Do you know their standard of living is that high? Do you know how much money they make on an average? They don't make $2,000 a year like we do. They're making $14,000 a year. And do you know the education? You know the schools they have? And the hospitalization and the insurance policies. Wow, democracy is great. That's what you do.
Did you always talk about politics? Because when you got started, Lenny Bruce was being prosecuted, wasn't he?
Well, he was already over. I saw him as a kid.
In those days, if you were a comedian and you said the wrong things, you would be arrested.
Well, if you say the wrong things now, you've got problems too.
Bill Maher losing
the
television
he lost
show.
His job. I mean, this is not exactly a free, open society for freedom of speech. But my father always read even though he was a numbers writer, you know, a bookie, he read the newspaper from front to back, every article in it, and was totally aware. And I was raised that way. And then I became a documentarian. I wrote, produced, and directed documentaries for several years dealing with the problems of the world. So I've always felt an obligation. I always felt it was obligatory to stay abreast of what's happening not only in this country but in the world.
You say your father was the funniest man you ever met.
Oh, absolutely.
Funnier than all the professional comedians you've
met. Absolutely. I have never met a man with better timing, faster mind, better delivery, more charming. I mean, he was brilliant, and it's a shame that he quit show business at a very young age.
To engage in illegal activities.
Well, he really didn't do that. That was his nature, I think, too. But my family was divided between the men with half rabbis and half gangsters. And my father, who was in the show business end of it, he came back to Philadelphia, and his father was a leading rabbi of Philadelphia. And he said to him, you can't work on Friday nights, Shabbat, you know, the Sabbath, you can't do it. You just can't have a job where you work Friday nights. And my father listened to his father and gave up show business, which proves don't listen to your father.
Did your father tell you to give up show business?
Never, but he never told me to go in it. The only thing is he would say, you know, get for security. But at the same time, he spun these webs, these dreams. Like he said to me when I was a kid, he said, you have no idea what it's like to stand on a stage with 2,500 people laughing at what you're saying. And then I did a show, my first show, for 25,000 people up in Canada. And I sent him a postcard the next day. I wish you could have been with me last night and experienced hearing 25,000 people laughing at what you say.
David Brenner is my guest. His book, I Think There's a Terrorist in My Soup, How to Survive Personal and World Problems with Laughter, Seriously. It's published by Andrews McMeel, and it's got blurbs from a wide range of people, from Johnny Carson to Bill O'Reilly to Richard Lewis, Kenneth Cole, the shoe guy.
Yeah, clothing guy, sure.
Bill Maher and Chris Matthews have written introductory words. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Can you tell us the story of when you were 6 years old and your father really sent you into...
Oh, you mean my first belly laugh?
Yeah.
Oh,
serious.
I love that story. Thanks for bringing that up.
The Tartucci brothers.
The Tartucci brothers. Well, I was living in South Philadelphia there on South 4th Street, and I knew what my father did for a living. You know, it was pretty obvious. He had regular jobs, but I would go with him, and the guys would come out and yell out the numbers they wanted to play. And my father was never arrested because he had a photographic memory for numbers. So, you know, like we'd pass a barber shop and five guys would come out and they go, "Hey, Lou, give me a 124 in a box for $5 and give me a one straight for $3. And he'd say, "Okay, Winky, you got it." You know, and whatever. And the next guy, "Give me 494 boxed, 50 cents each way." "Okay, nostrils, you got it." You know, and all the nicknames.
So no paper trail.
So then we would go to the head book and my father would recite the 100, 150 bets that he had, collecting the money and the bets and lay it all out. So I knew what he did. And I was home with my father. My mother was shopping. And there was a knock on the door. And we went to the door. And there were two men there standing on the front step wearing suits and ties. So we knew they're not from the neighborhood, unless they were dead. That's the only time you ever saw a guy in a suit and tie in that neighborhood with his arms folded. You know? And my father said, "What can I do for you, gentlemen?" He said, "Are you Mr. Brenner?" And he said, "Yes, I am." They pulled out, and this is not a mismemory, I remember that, they pulled out gold shields attached to billfolds. They were FBI men. And I figured, okay, here's my father's going. I knew, you know, that he was doing something nefarious. And even though I didn't know the word nefarious then. And I figured, all right, that's it, they're going to arrest my father. And he said, "How can I help you?" And they said, "Mr. Brenner, we want to talk to you about the Tartucci brothers." And he said, "I'm sorry, I don't know any Tartucci brothers." They said, "Mr. Brenner, the Tartucci brothers live three doors down from you," and they pointed to the left. And my father said, "When we leave the house, we always go this way," and he pointed to the right. And I went back into the living room, and I knew, I couldn't stop laughing, I knew I am living with one of the most unusual human beings ever put on this earth.
Was it weird living in that neighborhood, Brenner's, in a neighborhood that was mostly Sicilian?
Yeah, and some Slavic and people, and it was very difficult because...
So were you the only Jewish family?
No, there were just a couple others, but the problem I had is that my uncle was a rabbi, and above the front door was his shingle, Rabbi J. Gerson Brenner. So they knew anyone coming out of that house, unless he was black-skinned, and even then it could have been Jewish, was Jewish. And so I had a lot of anti-Semitism. I actually literally fought my way to school through the park, the little city park, and I had to cut across diagonally to get to my school. I used to fight to get to school, and I used to fight to get home.
The kids didn't know that their parents were placing bets with your father?
It didn't matter very much, you know. And the thing about it is, until I got into a street gang, I had problems. Once I got into the street gang, my nickname, ironically, or maybe appropriately, was Dubby, which my father called me then, which means little bear. Dubby the Hebrew. So my nickname was Dubby the Hebrew in a very tough Gentile gang.
Were you the class clown?
Yeah, I was a class comedian, class president. Yeah, I'm the antithesis of most comedians, I think. I was very popular. I loved my parents. My parents weren't neurotic. I was never beaten. I had a loving family.
You did well with women, you say.
I went with beautiful women.
Because half of the routines of young comics is can't get a date anymore.
That was just an impossible situation for me. It was absolutely, a friend of mine once said, "You're like a ball of molasses thrown into a fly party." He once said, I was always lucky with it. I always loved the girls when I was a little kid and women when I got older.
When did you realize that you wanted to be a comic?
I never wanted to be a comedian. I knew I was very funny, of course. But I never wanted to be a comedian. When I stopped doing documentaries, and...
That was in Philly?
No, it was in New York. Mm-hmm. I was the head of documentaries for Westinghouse and then Metro Media here. And when I got to the point where I realized that in my youthful naivete, I thought that I would present the problems associated with a problem and then possible solutions, and then it would change the world. Mm-hmm. And
I think that's what drives most documentary filmmakers, mm-hmm. at least the first three films.
Yeah, at least the first three. Well, look at me. I did a lot of films. And then I realized one day we have the answers. If you read the Quran, the Old Testament, the New Testament, Buddha, Zen, there's an answer to every human problem and society problem that exists. But we don't want to implement the problems. Of course, there's money in poverty. There's money in drugs. You know. So... I said, what am I doing? I'm not changing the world. And then I saw a B-movie, a real bad B-movie. Not that bad. It was about saving someone from going to the electric chair up in Boston. And there was a man marching with a placard in protest of the capital punishment. And he stopped at the governor's mansion, which was gated. And there was a cop behind a gate. And he asked the cop for a light for a cigarette. And the cop said to him, "What are you trying to do, mister? You can't change the world." And this man said, "You don't understand, officer. I'm not trying to change the world. I'm just trying to keep the world from changing me." And I sat there in the movie and I said, "That's it. I'm not going to feel guilty about leaving documentaries." So I did stand-up comedy as a lark. I'd been working since I'm 8.5 years old.
But there were no comedy clubs in those
days. Oh, yeah, in the village. A lot in the village. Oh, yeah.
I mean, like the Café Juan.
And in the Improv. Café Juan. Yeah, you know, the Champagne Gallery on McDougal. There were a lot. And then you would force your way into a place. You go and you see a jazz band. You say, "Listen, when they take their 15-minute break, can I get up and do some stand-up?" And owners would say, "Yeah, go ahead." They wouldn't have to pay you. Mm-hmm. That's what I did.
So you learned on the job.
I learned on the job, and then I was about to quit, but I wanted to do one TV show. So when people challenged that I was a stand-up comedian, I could show them the tape. And I went on the Tonight Show, and I had $10,000 worth of job offers the next day, and I realized I hit the mother load.
But no sitcoms. Or did you get sitcoms?
Yeah, offers? I had a sitcom in 1976. Jimmy Komak, who produced Chico and the Man and Welcome Back, Kotter, selected me to play the role of Warren Beatty from Shampoo, the womanizing hairdresser, and with Leslie Ann Warren as the co-star. And it was called Snip. And we did 7 shows. 5 of them we finished. They were in the can. And for the first time in the history of television, to this day, still, it's never been happened again, our show was yanked the Friday before we were to debut the next week. Now, the reason it was yanked, there were a lot of rumors going around. The reason it was yanked, this is 1976, we had a hairdresser. It was a gay guy playing a gay part. And NBC got cold feet and didn't want to have a gay man on television, so they pulled the series. Now, you better have a gay guy. You could be doing something about the SEALs, the Navy SEALs, the toughest guys we got. You better have a gay SEAL. You have to have a gay person.
At least one for
one.
Every sitcom.
And preferably one who's half Hispanic and half black, now, and partially woman. Perfect coverage.
But it's good that you mentioned SEALs. You're on a pet show now, aren't you?
Oh, goodness. Don't tell me you saw that. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You know, it's typical reality TV in a sense, but it's so much fun. They have pets that compete by doing tricks, and I'm on the jury of selecting which voting for these people. It's so much fun.
People do get rather neurotic about their pets, don't
they? Oh, please. It's sick. I mean, it's sick what people are with their pets.
When I introduced David Brenner, I said his latest book is "I Think There Is a Terrorist in My Soup." Actually, this is his fifth book, I think?
Yeah, fifth one, yeah.
And this one is from Andrews McMeel Publishing. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on WNYC. Stay with us. I'm Leonard Lope. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm talking with David Brenner, who you'd expect to see on shows like Letterman, Larry King, I guess Howard Stern as well, but Chris Matthews and the Fox News Network, well, that's because he is interested in more than just stand-up shtick, and his latest book is another indication of that. It's called "I Think There's a Terrorist in My Soup, How to Survive Personal World Problems with Laughter Seriously." It is published by Andrews McMeel. Now, there have always been comics who've done political stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mort Saul.
Mort Saul was great, yeah. Lenny Bruce.
But then Mort Saul's politics changed and he fell out of favor. Mm-hmm. Is it really harder doing political humor because you've got to change every day?
Yes, it's very difficult. Just to stay current is very difficult.
Did some of them, like Jay Leno and David Letterman, they have scores of writers.
14 writers, 15 writers. I have me. Uh-huh. But I write on stage. It doesn't make it better. It's not a qualitative statement. I write on stage. I ad lib. I just cut out from the newspaper something, and I think that might spark an idea, and I put it on a card. And while I'm working on stage, I flip the cards and either hear myself telling a joke about it or not. But then only a few things are evergreen. We know that poverty and drugs are going to be here forever, so you can always do jokes about them. But some things are evergreen. Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's going to be yesterday's newspaper in a few days unless he wins. And then he'll be, you know, the butt of more jokes. So it's very difficult, and you lose the material quickly. So in that way. And the most difficult thing is that you read all this horrible stuff to get to the ones that you can joke about.
Well, you said he'll be the butt of all jokes, but you're keeping abreast of the sexual harassment situation.
Yeah, well, I think they're going to, you know, I think it might be untrue. I think it may be just the opposite. I think he may have admired women and groped Adolf Hitler. That's what I think.
Well, this is a problem for anyone in politics. We do have pasts, and we've had people who – we had a Supreme Court judge who was remembered smoking a lot of pot up for the Supreme Court, and he didn't make it.
But it's always been that way. It's always been that way. Every president – just about every president messed around.
Why do you think some get more of a pass than others? George Bush – and a pretty they made a big stink about Bill Clinton saying he didn't inhale, and George Bush, I think, is admitted to having
drugs
early
and
in
alcohol
his life.
Problems. Yeah. Yeah, drug and alcohol problems. You know, but he didn't, what he said was he didn't admit to it. He said I haven't done anything in the last 7 years. He didn't. But what about before that? He didn't get into that. You know. But I think that if you're going to go look, I don't vote for men to as husbands, and I don't vote for women as wives. I vote for politicians, the politic, and I don't care what a man does in his private life who works for me or works for me in the government. I really don't care as long as it doesn't interfere with the job he's doing. And therefore, I don't judge people unless I judge myself. And people in show business especially, we have the opportunity to go astray. It's there. It's just and
you have
one,
David.
Yes, of
course. You reveal in
but
this
I'm
book.
Not running for office. If I ran for office, I would come out now and say, "Look, I'm telling you right now, there are going to be a lot of women are going to talk about me being with them. All right, a lot of women. Let's get that out of the way right now. That's true. And then, now, but here's the story. I could do a job. That would be like stopping me from writing my book because of my mistakes in the past. And some of them, I don't think were mistakes. I think it was a lot of fun.
Well, you couldn't. You had problems keeping a marriage going. Do you think that was mm-hmm. because is that a generational thing? You're coming of age in the 60s.
No, I think
your parents stayed married, didn't they?
Yeah, my parents stayed married for 65 years. You know, but people stayed married then. I think people today don't want to be unhappy. And if you're unhappy, you know, if you go to a boring party and it's boring, you get out of it. You leave the party. If you have a job and you hate your job, leave your job. And if you have a marriage and you don't like the marriage, leave the marriage. Whatever it is, you gotta, you know, you're here for just a little flick of a light, boom, and then you're gone. You might as well have fun with it. You know?
Now, your three kids, your sons, are the grandsons of Louis Yehuda Brenner, but you've given them the names Cole, Slade, and Wyatt Destry. It sounds more like a Wild West.
Well, it is. I make Jew cowboys. This is my specialty. If anybody wants a Jew cowboy, I can knock them out like crazy. I just like those names. And they're all named after, of course, you know, and being Jewish, they're named after people in my family in respect of, you know, people who have died. So, but they are anglicized, I guess, names. But, you know, what's in a name?
They've all had kids, and is that where you're there's something on page 23 where you talk about the questions that new parents always get asked.
Oh.
Is that you don't have to look it up, but I just wonder whether these sorts of routines grow out of your personal life.
Absolutely. Everything in the book comes out of personal. It's all personal.
Because in an earlier generation, fathers never were part of the whole birthing
experience.
Well,
not the birthing.
And now you're writing about that, too.
Well, I'll tell you something. I'm writing about it, but for all the men who are listening to you who are about to go through the birthing experience and are being talked to by their wives or the doctors to be there in the birthing room, and what an experience. I can tell you right now, it was the worst moment of my life. And don't go. There's no reason to go. We weren't meant to go.
Really?
We can be on the battlefield. That is nothing compared to this. When you start to see that ugly, slimy thing sliding out, it is disgusting.
That's your child.
I don't care. It's got to be hosed off and dressed. I mean, you see right away, you don't want to see it for at least 14 years when you're in that birthing room. The other way, you take a baby home, it's clean. Okay, you can get along with it. But not from that birthing room. That was one experience. I have never been nervous, and I don't get nervous and scared, and I was terrified. All the women, it was only women, all the doctors. I mean, I was the only man, and I was like an idiot. And then they made me cut the umbilical cord. Are they nuts? They told me it's very tough to cut it hard. You know what I was thinking? Raw scungili. I was thinking scungili. This is what I was thinking. Calamari, scungili.
So you really do think that there are places for men and there are places for women?
Yeah, I believe in equality and pay and in voting and all that, you know, sort of thing. But there are traditional roles that we play. I wouldn't expect this, like the lion, to stay home like the lion while the lioness goes out and hunts and runs the danger. I don't think that's fair, but I guess lions do it. But I think that, look, I made a deal with my, who turned out to be my wife. We had children without being married. and should have stayed without being married. That's what ruined it all. But anyway, I made her a deal. I would have another child. I already had a little boy. I said, I'll have another child, but here's the deal. I have nothing to do with openings, nothing to do with the physical openings of a human being. That means the nose, the mouth, the ear, you know, all openings. I don't put anything in the opening. I don't take anything out of the opening. If you leave me out of the responsibility of openings, then I can have a kid. I'm not changing diapers. I'm not, you know, oh, there's something in his nose.
You're not going to feed the kid nothing?
That's not for me. I don't enjoy it. I don't want to do it. Now, I'm divorced, and I have two sons, and I have them half the time, and there I am. There I am. I mean, doing it all.
But don't you like that, the bonding?
No, I think it's disgusting. I'd rather, what bind? Would you like to bind with a guy next to you on a bus who's throwing up, or a guy's just talking to you? What do you mean binding?
Is this why you, this kind of thinking, the reason you believe that political correctness is ruining comedy?
Yeah, I think it's ruining comedy and a lot of other things. I think, you know, I always was very proud of the fact that I lived in a country, and I lived in some neighborhoods that were quilts, really, different pattern people. You know, I lived with everybody, Greeks, Armenians, Italians, Irish, Arab American, black. I was the only white kid in a black neighborhood for years. And it was a melting pot. It was like a melting pot. We all worked together, got along together. We all watched television. We all watched the same TV shows. Now, there should have been more blacks on television. Should have been more Latinos. But there shouldn't be a Latino channel network, a black network. And you're separating us. It's separating us. We don't know enough about each other.
But on the other hand, there was a time before we even knew the phrase political correctness where a show like All in the Family couldn't have been on. Even now, The Sopranos
couldn't be on.
Get a lot of people angry, but hey, they win every award that you can get.
Look, let's be honest about this. The Sopranos was offered to all three networks. They turned it down. That shows you their wisdom, and it also shows you why, you know, there's horrible broadcasting on the networks. Thank goodness it's on HBO. Can you imagine it being on like CBS where a gangster gets shot, a mafia guy gets shot? He go, oh, golly gee whiz, this really stings like heck. I'm going to get you, you poopy head. I mean, what kind of, you know, let's be real here. The world's not that way. It never was that way. It was disillusionment, you know. The world has always been rough and tough and tumble. And that's the way it is. And let's be honest with each other. And let's stop separating it. Why do we have to have music that's only for blacks? Music that's only for Latinos? What is this? And why are we speaking two languages in this country? There are 224 dialects spoken in New York City at home. You used to go out on the street, everyone spoke English. I mean, I grew up with people from all over the world. They learned English. Why all of a sudden we have a group of people who can't learn English and their language is the closest to English as you can get? You know, once you learn, you can speak Spanish. You pick up a book, I can read Spanish. Why do we have to have two signs? Why do we have the two? Why didn't we have it in Russian? Why wasn't it in Italian? Why isn't it in Arabic? Why isn't it in Chinese? Why isn't it in Yiddish? Why isn't, you know, why only Spanish and English? Why? Because there are a lot of them. What does that matter? There were once a lot of Germans here. We didn't have German signs. Germans were the largest minority one time. Why didn't we have Achtung on the door? You know? Machen Sie links, make a left. Why didn't we have that? Machen Sie rechts, make a right. We didn't have that. We had make a left, make a right.
Well, actually, your father would never have gone to the right because that's where the Tartucci brothers were.
That's right. Right, the Tartucci.
You said that you were in a small town watching the news when the police interrupted the broadcast to announce that someone had stolen an Oscar Wiener mobile.
Yeah.
And then they gave the license plate.
Yeah. Just in case other large hot dogs are riding around where you live.
like nobody would have noticed.
Yeah, like, I don't think that's the right hot dog. Check the license.
Just one more thing. Have there been favorite presidents for you as a comedian? Are they all the same? Can you find funny stuff no matter who's the president?
You know, they are easily the butt of jokes. But when this election was happening, I knew Al Gore would be a lot of fun. But I just knew George W. Bush was going. I mean, when I heard him say, you know, it isn't pollution that's ruining our environment, it's the impurities in our air and water that's doing it, I said, get this guy elected because I'm going to have four great years.
But why do you think he hasn't really been called on those kinds of things since 9/11?
Because of 9/11.
Yeah, but it's been 2 years now.
I gave him 1 week's grace. I gave him through the weekend of the 14th, the weekend of the 21st of September 2001. I was on top of him right then, even though he was our leader and all that. Because I was thinking, wait a minute, how did this man get so smart overnight? How did he flip-flop that quickly to make me flip-flop? I mean, this is a guy who came out with statements You know, when he said, you know, we have to get together, that means we have to unite. I mean, come on. Come on. I you know, kids are smarter than that in third grade. Well, not so much in America, but kids are smarter than that. And then how did he come out with these words, these pearls of wisdom?
At least he knows how to spell potato.
Yes, he does.
David Brenner's latest book, I Think There's a Terrorist in My Soup, How to Survive Personal and World Problems with Laughter Seriously. It's published by Andrews McMeel.
Could I just say about the...
I'll tell him.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks a lot.